two of you are back there. Rest your thumb. I don't know how many of you have ever passed through Binghamton, but if you were to suddenly materialize downtown, you might think, this is a nice place. You see a stately courthouse, noble brick, and quarried stone, 19th century building, a tastefully landscaped traffic circle, leafy trees shading the courthouse green, a tall 19th century Civil War monument. Looking down the main avenue toward the Shenango River, the lines are drawn in pleasant places. Shops, restaurants, benches, trees. While there are some more modern and incongruous storefronts and buildings, and even a dollar store, if you squint, the aesthetic is overall serene, designed for human habitation and happiness. But if you were to get in your car and drive beyond downtown to what is called the Vestal Parkway, you would find a very different aesthetic. Functional blocks of brick and cement and glass, separated by barren expanses of asphalt and parked cars. Lowe's, Starbucks, Walmart, Target, and we just got a Chili's. It's the strip mall that we're all familiar with. There are in places sidewalks running along the parkway, but nobody walks on them. Crazy people that walk on them, but nobody else walks in them. Several wooded suburban neighborhoods spill onto or into the parkway. There's Binghamton University, which has trees and fields. And if you lift your gaze up, you'd see a rolling forested hill or hills sloping into the valley. But these are so obscured and crowded by the river of cement and asphalt and loud signage, and it's easy to forget them. Recently, as my family and I were floating down this river, we noticed that two particularly ugly abandoned restaurants had been mercifully razed to the ground, and there were no more, and that large machines were digging out a foundation for something new. And so we prayed, oh, please, Lord, can we have nice things? Let it not be an ugly building. Soon thereafter, we learned that it would be a hotel. Okay, we thought. It might be a nice-looking hotel. Who knows what the future holds? Well, the future held a multi-storied cement box with tinted windows. Still, painted white or cream, it would at least fit with the other cement blocks with windows. Then the painter showed up to accent the corners. Blue rectangles, black stripes, and yellow thrown in there at various places. It was and is a crime against cement and boxes. When Jared asked me to come up with a topic for this conference, I just finished reading Return of the King. I read the whole series every year, just finished Return of the King. I just come to the end of it. If you have read the last two chapters of Return of the King, you may, like me, have unresolved anger issues with Peter Jackson. The film hobbits, if you remember the end of the movie, the film hobbits come home to the same leafy, flower-lined lanes and byways they left. The film shire remained untouched. Jackson, God have mercy on his soul, omitted the two, I think, most poignant and crucial chapters of Tolkien's work. While Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin had been off in the wars, the holes, the gardens, the fields, the forests, the inns and paths, that the pastoral Eden of the Shire had been deconstructed. Lotho Baggins, Frodo's kinsman, who bought Bag Inns from Frodo, after Frodo's departure, started, and this is according to Farmer Maggot, to get funny ideas. He wanted to own everything himself and then order folk about. He already did own a sight more than was good for him. He was always grabbing more and more, though. And where he got the money was a mystery. Well, we know where he got the money. He got the money from Saruman. Knowing Gandalf's love for the Shire, Saruman hated it and found a way, Lotho, to express his malice. Lotho bought the best fields and the mills and the inns, and he sent food and pipeweed and beer away to Orthanc. And when hobbits began to complain about the shortages, Lotho sent to Saruman for help, and Saruman dispatched big people, ruffians, to the Shire. And as Farmer Maggot tells us, things went from bad to worse. There wasn't no smoke left, save for the men. And the chief, that's Lotho, didn't hold the beer, save for his men. And closed all the inns, and everything except rules got shorter and shorter. Unless one could hide a bit of one's own, when the ruffians went round gathering stuff up for, quote-unquote, fair redistribution. Which meant they got it, and we didn't. Trees were felled, block houses were built, gardens plowed over, factories belching black smoke were erected, all for the common good. Most hobbits hated it, quietly. A few smelled opportunity. There's hundreds of sheriffs, all told, Robin Smallborough tells Sam, and they want more with all these new rules. Most of them are in it against their will, but not all. Even in the Shire, there are some as like minding other folks' business and talking big. And worse than that, there's a few as do spy work for the chief and his men. The sheriffs erected gates to keep hobbits from traveling and guardhouses and lock holes for rule breakers. In the 13 months between Frodo's departure and his return, the Shire became ugly and desolate and perilous. If you remember, Frodo left the Shire to preserve it. I'm a danger to all who live here, he said. I can't keep the ring and stay here. I ought to leave Bag End, leave the Shire, leave everything and go away. I should like to save the Shire if I could, though there have been times when I thought the inhabitants too stupid and dull for words, and have felt that an earthquake or an invasion of dragons might be good for them. But I don't feel like that now. I feel that as long as the Shire lies behind, safe and comfortable, I shall find wandering more bearable. I'll know that somewhere there is a firm foothold, even if my feet cannot stand there again. Now instead, Frodo returns from Mordor to the Shire's ruin. Now, reading of the felled trees and the rules and the ruffians, the guardhouses and the locked gates, when I read that, I'm not sure about you, when I read that, it evokes in me, and I think Tolkien meant for it to, it evokes in me anger of a species that doesn't arise from any other scene in the trilogy. For years, I didn't know why those particular chapters struck me this way. I mean, I've never myself personally lived in the English countryside, which the Shire depicts. I was born on the Gulf Coast and raised in a city. But the idea of the Shire taps into a deep longing. If you had a good childhood, I had a good childhood. If you had a good childhood, you likely remember your childhood home in golden hues, its beauty and its comfort untouched by the losses and evils that came along with adulthood. Even if you didn't have a good childhood home, Tolkien's description of the Shire is meant to make you long for one. The aesthetic of the Shire is meant to make you long for a sacred home. Its agrarian beauty is bound up with it. And so the thought of its violation, of its beauty desecrated, evokes, or I think Tolkien wants it to evoke, zealous, even religious rage. Now, the Lord of the Rings is all through, shot all through, with an appeal to the beauty of sacred places. The beauty of holiness, the prayer book might call it. The wild, verdant comeliness of Goldberry in her house. Rivendell, the elven home, emerging out of river and valley and tree and stone as if it's one piece with them. The Malorn trees of Lothlorien, their white trunks and golden leaves. Home to Galadriel, perhaps the most beautiful being in Middle-earth. Stark, wind-swept Edoras, the fading grandeur of Minas Tirith, and its tower jutting like a ship's prow from the mountain. The great urgency to destroy the ring is at once a desire to save the free peoples of Middle-earth and to preserve the sacred beauty of their homes. These are arrayed against the backdrop of the looming shadow and the corruption in its wake. Minas Ithil, once the Tower of the Moon, filled with unspeakable creatures. Moria, infested by orcs and trolls, its glittering halls darkened. The stench of bloated death and rotted evil in Shelob's lair. The shriveled, hairless golem, once a plump hobbit. And the treeless desolation of Mordor in the Dark Tower. Evil in The Lord of the Rings and ascetic ruin, uglification, to use Lewis's word, are bound up together. As we all know, and Tolkien will make good use of this, goodness is often concealed within a decaying body, and evil is often concealed within enthralling beauty. But that we are fooled by such disjunctions underscores the underlying presupposition of Lord of the Rings and our own souls, that what is good should appear so, and what is evil should repel. So maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. What is beauty anyway? You'll notice I've not said, the Shire is beautiful to me. Or, Mordor is ugly to me. I've said the Shire is beautiful and Mordor is ugly. Can we speak about beauty that way? Marxist theorists, is anyone here a Marxist? I don't want to offend anybody. Marxist theorists will tell you there's no such thing as beauty. Beauty is a bourgeois construct, they say. You have been trained to see the English countryside, which the Shire depicts, as beautiful. It's really, if you can see through it, it's really raw material for agricultural production and redistribution and industrial development. You're taught to find the pastoral landscape enjoyable because that pleasure that we all feel keeps the land in the hands of private owners and away from the people. See, once you learn to see through things, the whole notion of beauty collapses. You'll see that the beautiful landscape, the grand building, the beautiful poem, song, all that does is mask oppression. The grand old building isn't sacred. It's a criminally inefficient use of common space and material. The flower garden isn't a pleasant escape. It's wasted acreage The Song of Roland isn't a heroic epic depicting a knight's glorious death. It's a prop for the aristocratic myth of chivalry, a brick in the fortifications protecting elite privilege. The rules governing the composition of classical music don't ensure good music. There's no such thing. The rules center European culture. And so for all these reasons, beauty must be disrupted, not merely by building blockish factories over fields of wildflowers, but by subverting art and music and language, disrupting the rules of aesthetics, raising the people's consciousness so they see through beauty to the oppressive power that it conceals. This Marxist analysis has been widely propagated and disseminated through various critical theories, so that in colleges and in corporate diversity training sessions, you're taught to see through racial and sexual and family relationships to spot the oppressor-oppressed binary. Those relationships heal. But seeing through good beauty, pretending beauty is a construct and then deconstructing it, is something you have to learn to do. You don't do it naturally. Roger Scruton fleshes this out in On Beauty, very short but really good book. The concept of and the longing for beauty is found in every culture, in every historical period, and tellingly, within every class, which indicates that beauty is not a bourgeois construct at all, and that the longing for beauty is constitutive of human nature. Tolkien appeals to this longing throughout Lord of the Rings, but his appeal reaches its crescendo, I think, in what many consider the anticlimax or epilogue of his work. The Shire, deconstructed and restored. Think about the other sacred homes, Rivendell, Lothlorien, Ithilien, Edoras, and even Minas Tirith, Minas Tirith did suffer in the war. All the other beautiful sacred homes Tolkien introduces us to are preserved from utter desecration, not the Shire. And I think that in its ruin, Tolkien issues a challenge. Tell me now that beauty is an illusion. That utility, that use matters more than aesthetics. Tell me that beauty isn't bound up with goodness and truth, and thus not worth fighting for. Now, that beauty might be an absolute or a transcendent thing is a hard sell. Again, I ask if anyone here is a Marxist. I don't think anyone here is a Marxist, but it's a hard sell to Americans, regular Americans. In America, utility often supersedes aesthetics, which is why every city has its Vestal Parkway. If a cheap cement box serves the purpose more efficiently than a stone building, build a box. Whatever works. And besides, we say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Now, at some level, I think we've all swallowed that last notion, that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You and I don't share the same taste in art or music, so can we really say there's some objective quality called beauty? One person likes Thomas Kincaid, the other Caravaggio, but doesn't it all come down to personal taste? One thing is beautiful to me, another thing is beautiful to you. There's no such thing, therefore, as beauty in an absolute sense, just personal preference. Now, I don't think, even though we might say things like that, I don't think anybody really truly believes that. C.S. Lewis, if you've read Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis begins the book by observing that nobody really believes that there's no absolute standard for right and wrong, because everyone appeals to the standard all the time. I got here first. It's your turn to clean the kitchen. I did it last night. You broke your promise. All of those are an appeal to some transcendent standard. If people really believed that there's no absolute transcendent good, they wouldn't appeal to it 20 times a day. The same is true of beauty. If we really believed that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, there would be no aghast horror when someone says Thomas Kincaid is better than Caravaggio, or that Xanadu, anyone see Xanadu, is a better opera than The Marriage of Figaro. You have to Google, go home and Google Xanadu. It's like an 80s rock opera. It's hilarious. Nobody would be aghast when someone says that Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, is better than Casablanca. We all believe there's something transcendent about beauty, or we wouldn't argue about it. It's one thing to say, I like Thomas Kincaid better than Monet, which embarrassingly I do. I mentioned this in a sermon a long time ago, and I've not heard the last of it. It's one thing to say, I like Thomas Kincaid better than Monet, which, again, is embarrassing. It's another to say, Thomas Kincaid is better than Monet. The first can perhaps be forgiven in a fallen world. The second is insufferable. Taste, of course, doesn't define beauty. It recognizes beauty. Some of you may be shocked that the leaders of this conference asked someone to speak on beauty and natural theology and Tolkien, who likes Thomas Kincaid. But regardless of my personal taste or their bad choices, we are right now bumping up against an idea with a long, and I would say even eternal, heritage. The reason everyone believes that beauty is absolute and transcendent is because it is. Classically, there were three primary transcendentals, qualities that are, whether people recognize them or not: truth, goodness, and beauty. Christians have, up to very recently, embraced all three. Jordan Cooper, a Lutheran, but we can forgive him, suggests that, and I think he's right, that generally contemporary American evangelicals affirm the first two, truth and goodness, but have forgotten, or at least learned to see through, the third. Within the seeker-sensitive megachurch worship tradition, for example, aesthetics serve a utilitarian purpose. You want to use music and lighting and architecture to evoke ecstasy, a feeling of love, which is really eros, not love, as we would understand the Christian realm. You want to evoke eros for Jesus. And so the music and the lighting and the architecture become tools, utilitarian tools, to evoke passion. It doesn't matter if the architecture is beautiful or whether the music is true and sublime. Does it get the job done? And so you sing the same chorus 57 times in a row in a room with no windows and a fog machine and dancing stage lights, not to draw hearts and minds to consider the glory of God and his character, or his beauty and the beauty of things that he's made, but to produce personal experiences, personal ecstasy. It's the ecclesiastical version of the strip mall. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, there are those who think every bit of art and or beauty, anything that touches the senses, is a distraction from the pure intellectual contemplation of God in worship. So you want a bare room and a pulpit, and that's it. Now, it's very difficult to read God's instructions to Moses for the tabernacle and conclude that God is in any way utilitarian when it comes to aesthetics. God could have just said, hey, throw up a tent, build a box,
bring in a torch or something, set up a table, and that'll do. I don't want you to be distracted. No, God said, I want an ark of acacia wood coated in gold. And I want a golden lampstand. And then I want a golden table. And then I want a golden incense altar. I want incense. And I'll tell you the recipe. It's going to be my recipe you use. I want blue and purple and gold curtains and vestments to match the curtains. The tabernacle is beautiful. It inspires awe, but it never descends to titillation. There's no golden harp in there to get people's hearts moving. The golden lampstand, its oil lamps flickering, casting its light onto the golden table with the 12 loaves, and the incense altar, the smell of frankincense lingering in the air, light, bread, the aroma that overwhelms the smell of corruption. The tabernacle is a feast for the senses over which Yahweh himself presides. The modern person may see through its parts. That's just a tent. That's just a curtain. That's just bread. That's just a table. Or see the splendor, but crave ecstasy. Both miss that these gold objects bathed in candlelight reflect and even participate in a reality not made with hands. The true temple in heaven. The beauty made with hands compels us to contemplate and worship the Creator who is its source and its measure. Consider creation itself. God has not consulted Occam on how he should do things. He's filled his canvas with breathtaking grandeur and beauty, much of it functionally unnecessary. What use is there for a panda? What do pandas do? I mean, they might fertilize stuff, possibly. But really, I mean, you could get along without a panda, I think. I can't think of any reason for them, but I love watching panda videos. You like watching panda videos? I love watching panda videos. And I love God more after I watch panda videos. God might have designed our eyes without the capacity to see color. He could have made our ears deaf to all but the sounds absolutely necessary for communication. He might have given us only the dullest sense of smell to know whether a thing is poisonous and might kill us. He might have given us tongues less sensitive to taste and paired our tongues with bodies that needed only to be fueled by gray glop from stagnant pools. But our eyes see color. Our ears distinguish harmony from cacophony. We can smell perfume and incense, and smell even evokes memories of past places and times. We eat not just to live, but to enjoy living. Creation, as Calvin tells us, and it's one of his favorite sections of the Institute, is the theater of divine glory. That God made it so, and has given us what we need to revel in that theater, tells us that beauty, along with goodness and truth, finds its source and its definition and its measure in Him. So to enjoy true beauty is also to enjoy God. Plato, by the way, said the same. He saw material beauty as kind of a stepladder. You enjoy the flower you see in the field, you look at it, you contemplate it, but what happens to the flower? The flower dies, it passes away. So if you're pursuing the actual beauty of the thing, the beauty draws you to things that don't pass away, to a contemplation of a higher kind of beauty that remains, and that ultimately leads you to God, said Plato. But, and Plato would be very quick to warn you, don't get stuck in the lower rungs of that ladder. True beauty, he would say, is beyond what the eyes can see. Now, there's truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. The incarnation, the resurrection, scandalizes the Platonic mind. God embodied truth, goodness, and beauty in flesh. But in the end, not so that that flesh weathers away. The Christian knows, I hope, that in Christ, God began to restore his ruined creation, the beautiful one who once could not be seen, has bound himself to that which we see and taste and touch to liberate it from its bondage to futility. So that one day even the flower will not pass away. But to effect that liberation from bondage, he had first become subject to it, submitting to infirmity and death to overturn them. As Strider reminds us, all that is gold does not glitter. Jesus, at his first coming, except for the transfiguration, did not glitter. And no matter how many times we sing at him, he's not going to shine, Jesus shine. He was plain, ordinary. There was nothing to attract us to him. Conversely, some corrupting things in this yet unfully restored world seem to radiate beauty for those enraptured by them. Thus it is in a fallen and ruined world. The writers stirred at first, murmuring with approval of the words of Solomon, and then they too were silent as men spellbound. Over their hearts crept a shadow, the fear of great danger, the end of the mark in a darkness to which Gandalf was driving them, while Saruman stood beside a door of escape, holding it open so that a ray of light came through. What have you to say, Theoden King? Will you have peace with me and the aid that my knowledge, bounded in long years, can bring? Shall we make our counsels together against evil days and repair injuries with such goodwill that our estates shall both come to fairer flower than ever before? Saruman's words, even in the flotsam of Orthanc, are alluring. For a time, we're told in the Silmarillion that Sauron could appear in noble form. It requires wisdom to see through these things to the truth. There is a kind of seeing through or deconstruction in Lord of the Rings, and in reality as well. The temptress is tempting because she's beautiful. You and I don't take hold of an evil thing because we think it's ugly. We think it's precious. The ring, of course, is like sin, the epitome of this dichotomy in Lord of the Rings. And to those who take hold of it, it's beautiful, it's lovely, it's precious. Well, what's the difference, we should ask, between seeing through the beauty of the ring, that it's really death and horror for those who take hold of it, and seeing through the beauty of the Shire so as to cut down the trees and fill the hobbit holes? The answer for Tolkien, and it's the Christian answer, has to do with truth and goodness, to which the good, wholesome, divine sort of beauty is always bound. In a world unstained by evil, that which seems beautiful would always be good and true. But in a world in which evil devours like a parasite, corrupting the inner person while leaving the outward appearance untouched, and where age and sickness corrupt the body, masking a redeemed soul made new, appearances can deceive. Knowing what is good and true, knowing God, makes distinguishing between appearance and true beauty both necessary and possible. When Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin return to the Shire, they are changed hobbits, hobbits transformed. Had they not gone there and back again, one wonders if they might have been caught up in the desolation. I don't think any of them would have been a sheriff, but maybe they would have kept their heads down, or waited quietly, like Farmer Maggot, for the Shire to rise up. But they had seen fire and sword, and they'd seen Elrond, Galadriel, and Gandalf risen from the pit, and Aragorn, the king. And so they return as hobbits made new, with eyes to see through the sheriffs and the feathers in their caps. They come to know truth, goodness, and beauty, and will not be fooled by appeals to the need to set things right. Nor will they love their lives so so much as to cower before big people with clubs. They come in the name of the king. With steel swords and the glint of battle in their eyes. They stroll through the gates. They ignore the rules. They defy the ruffians who don't recognize their peril, they learn. In fact, the collapse of the new order is bloody but quick, as is the restoration. Thanks to Galadriel's gift to Sam, which is a box of dust from Lothlorien, grains of which he planted throughout the Shire, we read this. Altogether, 1420 in the Shire was a marvelous year. Not only was there wonderful sunshine and delicious rain in due times in perfect measure, but there seemed to be something more. An air, and this is an important part, an air of richness and growth and a gleam of beauty beyond that of mortal summers that flicker and pass upon this middle earth. All the children born or begotten in that year, and there were many, were fair to see and strong. Most of them had rich golden hair that had before been rare among hobbits. The fruit was so plentiful, the young hobbits nearly bathed in strawberries and cream, and no one was ill, and everyone was pleased, except those who had to mow the grass. Sickness, ruin, desolation, all of it for one brief year in the Shire, undone. Note that language again. The gleam of the beauty of the Shire that year seemed to transcend what passes and fades. It was redolent of something beyond mortal summers that flicker and pass.
Heavenly beauty, we might say. A reflection of an eternal and sacred home.
You know, it was like that one year in Capernaum. Jesus walked through her gates and ignored the rules, with the glint of battle in his eyes, feasting with the tax collector, picking grain from the fields on the Sabbath, eating without ceremonially washing first, driving sickness and sorrow and death away, and putting the sword of his word to the spirits of darkness who, unlike the ruffians, knew their peril, bringing with him a beauty beyond that of mortal summers that flicker and pass. The end to which the scouring of the Shire leads, the argument that Tolkien makes by appeal to our longing for an unfading homeland of summers laden with vines and cream, is that there is a true beauty, a flower of truth and goodness, and there is one who is truly beautiful, and we all inherently long for him. And when he comes, the mortal summer will be swallowed up by an everlasting one. That's why the story Tolkien tells is so heartrending and satisfying at the same time. Now, we live in a day in which the untrue has taken hold and rules have gotten longer. You're expected to say that the man in the dress is a beautiful woman. You're expected to glory in the gay wedding, and to fawn over the brave deconstruction of the West, to forsake the old notions of truth, goodness, and beauty as tools of oppression. Well, that's all a lie. And we see through it because we've been with the king. So I hope you'll walk through the gates and ignore the rules and defy the ruffians who enforce them. I hope you'll laugh like hobbits at sheriffs with feathers in their caps and refuse to embrace any other paradigm than Christ as Savior and King and Victor over the world of flesh and the devil. You're his messenger. So should we then take sledgehammers to the hotel on the parkway? As satisfying as that would be, I have to say no. But I do think, and this is just a suggestion, I do think that we should do away, as Christians, we should do away with any notion of pragmatism, of utility, that teaches us to say beauty doesn't matter so long as this thing works. Function is important, absolutely, but we must not be tricked into playing the two against one another. They're not enemies. We should, of course, remember that in a fallen world, beauty can be misused, and it's often hidden behind a face and a body marred by disease, and in the souls of men and women who work in ugly hotels. But the ultimate end for the Christian
is the glory of Christ, who is the author of beauty.
So I think it matters, insofar as you can help it, how a thing is said, what color a thing is painted, how the thing is shaped. Does it reflect the goodness, truth, and beauty of the one who clothed himself in the corruption and ruin of our souls and bodies to remake them, so they will be fit for a world in which everything, from the smallest leaf to the tallest mountain, gleams with the eternal beauty. Am I supposed to answer questions or no? Okay, all right.
Any questions? Well, you know, ultimately, the age of elves and dwarves is fading, and the age of men is gonna start. They're gonna go off to their homes across the sea, or their home across the sea. So I think she's talking just about that. Is it now? And also, she had one of the three rings of the elves. So she, by that power that she had with that ring, was preserving and maintaining the beauty of Lothlorien, and the same thing with Elrond and Rivendell. And so when they leave, which they know they're going to have to, it's going to be fading. And so there is kind of a long defeat there. However, I think there's it's like a symphony that is it becomes darker and less brilliant. There's still these little notes of, hey, something in the future is coming that's really wonderful and brilliant. And I think that Tolkien would have us know that thing coming is Jesus and one day his kingdom. So, which all like all of that kind of in Tolkien's mind would reflect that in the past in the way that the scriptures point to it in the future. Does that help? Does that answer?
It does, yes.
Any other thoughts or questions? Or
I'm tracking with your thesis. Well, what I have a strong
That's a great question. I mean, Christians aren't the only ones who love beautiful things. The people who are not Christians do too. And of course, both Christians and non-Christians can misuse the beautiful things we love. We can use them for nefarious purposes. We can use them to entrap other people. We can use them in ways that entrap ourselves. So how do we not do that? I tried to hint at that in my talk, is that, you know, when Frodo and Sam and Pippin and Merry come back, they've been with the king. They know who he is. They've seen Galadriel, Elrond, all the rest. They have a marker. They have a foundation they can return to measure. Okay, is this thing really good or is it not? Is this thing really beautiful? I know it appears so, but is it really reflective of the true beauty or not? They have that capacity because they've been with the king. And I think we do too. I think we have the capacity to know, because Christ has revealed himself to us in the scriptures, we have the capacity to know what's good, to know what's true, and ultimately to say, that's a pretty looking thing, but that's going to hurt me if I take too much of that. So does that help?
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Sam and Frodo have those experiences of being with the king, but what about Sam and Frodo's children?
Good question. I mean, I hope Sam raises Rosie well and tells her all about the king and helps her to do the same thing. I mean, that's what we have to do too as Christians, don't we? We can't just let our kids, and here I'm going to be a hypocrite, we can't just let our kids like hang out online all day and play their games and not also inculcate in them an appreciation of the true, good, and beautiful things in this world, most importantly Christ. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I do think, and I mentioned this toward the end, I do think that, we can't control whether another parkway is built, so we can't control those kinds of things, but I can control what I write for a sermon. I mean, I can try to craft a good sentence. I can try to write in a way that draws minds and hearts above the ugly things and into what's truly beautiful. I'm not sure what you do, but whatever you do, you can do the same wherever you work. In a little small way, in your little small corner of your mind, we can tap into and elevate the beautiful over the ugly, I think. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yep.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think Dr. Sunshine mentioned something like that last night when he was talking about the Tolkien as an anarchist in the Shire, not like a communist anarchist, but an anarchist who says, you know, the less rules and the more people just relate to one another as human beings, and you know, mind one of those business, but also are together, the better. I mean, so I think you're right. I mean, the attempt to build a Shire-like community, I guess, is a good idea. In fact, I think the church is where God intends for us to do that primarily, and that's I think. I said online, and I'm not sure, this is just kind of a half thought out thought, that the Shire and Rivendell and Lothlorien and all those places I think are kind of pictures of different aspects of the church. Maybe Tolkien didn't mean it that way, but that's how I'm taking it. So that we can revel in. So yeah, other questions? Any other questions? Uh-oh, I hope not.
Decades in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd want to affirm that I think the longing there, which is they want a just community. I don't think that many of our contemporary critical theory advocates really want to do away with beauty like the Marxists did. They don't think they see the ends to which their ideas are headed or some of the roots of them. But I would affirm that longing for justice. I would affirm the desire to build a real community in which people share stuff and there's happiness for no one's starving and off. I mean, that's what they want. They want people to be good to one another despite skin color and they want things to be pleasant and nice. And I think that's where you start. But it's a great thing. But what you're using here isn't going to get you there. It's going to get you sheriffs with feathers in their hats and lock houses. It's not going to get you the Shire. So I think you could use begin with the good thing that the person is looking for and saying that's not going to get you there. Does that help? Because they do, because that person's made in God's image, and that person does, of course, that person's made to enjoy God forever, and that's what he wants or she wants. He just doesn't know it. So, yes. I didn't quite go into that as much as I wanted to. Well, it's part of that. I mean, it's a natural theology is just how we think about God apart from special revelation and being the scriptures, right? God reveals certain things to us that we wouldn't necessarily get from our observation of nature. And yet, we can observe nature and especially with the lens of scripture applied to it, understand more about God from the things that he's made and love God in greater ways because of the things he's made, like, you know, the panda, you know, I think that's I love pandas. But there are those things that God has made are, I think Plato had some insight here, are intended to bring us in this kind of step ladder up from this world to God. So that's natural theology, basically, yes. Yeah, it's a good. I think there's a fear that people have that okay, if I enjoy this thing too much, if I like the looks of this thing too much, it's going to become a god, and I'm going to let that supplant my love for God. And of course, if you have that tendency, don't do that. But I think there does need to be some maybe sanctification of that idea so that we recognize it's okay. It's really okay to enjoy this painting. It's good to sit down and look at the architecture of a well-made building and just love that. It's okay to sit in church, I think, and maybe I might be more dangerous ground here. It's okay in a church if there's a beautiful icon to look at that. I wouldn't pray through it, but to look at it and say this is a beautiful painting of my Lord or someone. I personally think that within the Christian realm, so long as we're not directing worship towards something, that we are free to, and in fact, we should enjoy them. By the way, if you want some fun for an afternoon, go home and Google, or go to if you're on Facebook, look up Soviet brutalism. There's an actual page devoted to Soviet brutalism, and it's that kind of architecture is specifically designed to do what I was talking about in this talk. The brutalist architects want to disrupt our understanding of beauty and show that it's really an illusion, and really they just ended up with a bunch of ugly buildings. So, any other questions or thoughts? How much time do I have? What's the time? You're good. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, I think two things. First, I think one of the reasons for that is there's kind of a disconnect on the left. They don't, like I was saying, there's some inconsistency, which is, in this case, is not so necessarily a bad inconsistency. I'm glad for the beautiful stuff they make. But on the other side, like I was saying a minute ago, I think for something happened, and I'm not sure when or where. I'd like to do more reading about this, but something happened in evangelical circles and conservative circles to where we kind of did adopt a more utilitarian mindset toward things. Whatever works, that's what we're going to do. And so we haven't, especially in the evangelical world, we haven't devoted ourselves to good, by good I mean classically good, art or music. We've devoted ourselves to the kind of a kitsch, right? Whatever, if it titillates the heart, that's good. That's what we do, and so that just produces ugly things ultimately, and it doesn't make any lasting aesthetic difference in our lives or those around us. So I do think that needs to be recaptured. This idea that that truth, goodness, and beauty go together, and beauty is not something that you can just cast aside as long as a thing works. That's such a dangerous, and I think it's done the dangerous idea. And I think it's done a lot of destruction. Answer a question? Yes. Right.
But that was the sentiment. There was a disintegration between beauty, appreciation, and its use and value.
Yeah. And that goes back to, someone had a question or a point over here about the elves leaving Middle-earth. I mean, Galadriel knew she was leaving, but what did she do with Lothlorien? She still made it beautiful. She kept it beautiful. But even though she was... she's only passing through this world. She's going to the next. So I think there's even though we're here for a short time, let's enjoy the time we're here and make it more beautiful when we're gone. Yeah.
Could that be why we've lost a generation of young people in the church? Not because they didn't have any catechesis, but because the church is so ugly. And why would we keep going if it's lost? You know, there's no compelling reason to show up on Sunday morning if it's unpleasant to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, to another moment of honesty here, I pastor a church that looks like it was designed by Bob Brady in the interior. if you look at the Brady Bunch house and you go to our church and you look at, it looks kind of like the Brady Bunch house. So I'm not sure I should be the one talking about beauty, but church architecture. But I do think that there is that sense that when someone comes, especially someone who hasn't grown up in the evangelical world, and they see the music, or they hear the music that we're playing, and the lights that are flashing all around, and the women or men or whoever writhing on stage singing, and it's like, okay, well, I can get this in a concert, or this is okay, I guess, but I mean, really, AC/DC is better, and I can go there. So I think
there is something that when someone walks into a church, I think they should feel like they're walking into a different country, not their own country, because it belongs to the King. So they should feel like they're in His kingdom, and that means their things are going to what they hear is going to be different from the pulpit and from the organ. If they don't like organ music, that's okay. Play it anyway. So there's got to be a sense that you are stepping into a different realm. And I think art and music will help create that.
Right.
And so that's the point.
That's a great point. I do think on some level my preference for Thomas Kincaid over Monet is a sin that I need to repent of. I mean, that's bad taste. How can I? What's wrong with me? Clearly, that's part of the fall. So I need to correct that. God, the Holy Spirit, to help me there. And I think you're right. Focusing on what is truly good and beautiful over time does, I think, correct those things in us and help us see what beautifully is. Yes?
Thinking about what you said about efficiency, replacing beauty, I have a question about the other side, that the Lord is order, and He's placed order in His creation. That's one way that we're led back to beauty.
I agree with that. Order is certainly that God is not the God of chaos. He's the God of order. And I do think that an aspect of beauty is order. Think of music. If you just hear a bunch of noise, it's cacophony. It doesn't do anything. So there's, I think, inherent in beauty is order. You wouldn't want to. I don't know, a beautiful car that doesn't drive. You want a functioning car that drives and is beautiful. All those things work. I don't mean at all to suggest that function and order are enemies. But I do think that the sin of our culture is to go too far into the utilitarian assessment of aesthetics. That's exactly right. So I think that especially for Christian artists, for Christian engineers, for Christian writers, lawyers, whatever it might be, if you keep in mind that the end is not just to get the thing done, right? It's also to glorify Christ. I think what you're saying then comes together. Okay, well, I'm not just making a table. I'm making a table for Jesus and for my customer, and I'm making money, and it all comes together. But they don't have to be. I don't have to just cut out the glory of Christ and just make the table so I can get my money. Does that make sense? Good question. Good talk. Yes.
One more question.
Okay. All right. Yes.
So now that we piggyback so much, we're actually going to tailor this.
Yeah, I think it's right. I mean, I think we've trained ourselves to see through things. C.S. Lewis talked about the habit of seeing through that modern people have developed, where anything that looks, you know, that is alluring or attractive or beautiful, the modern person might enjoy it, but is kind of trained to just say, "Bah, it's fluff." That move the fluff away. Let's see what it is in the center of it. So you dissect it and you cut it open, and then you have nothing. And that's where I think the modern habit of this kind of machine gets us. And I think we all just do it. I mean, you're right. This is something that's in our. I don't know where it comes from necessarily, but we all tend to do that. If I hear someone, sometimes when I'm sitting in church and I'm not preaching, and I'll just want to say, you know, get to the point. I know no one's ever says that to me, right? Because I mean, I'm fine. But other preachers, get to the point. And you know, maybe of course preachers should get to the point. But there is also an art and a beauty in the crafting of language that's part and parcel of the delivery of a sermon that we should, you know, listen for, as well as the point, also the vehicle in which the point is carried. So it's retraining our minds, I think, to do that. Are there any other? Oh, we're done. That's the last question. I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here. Thank you. Thank you.